Johannes. Yeah, that's better. All right, today I'd like to talk to you about supersymmetric string compactifications on non-Kähler, non-Calabi-Yau twisted tori that are related to 2B compactifications on torus orientifolds by T-duality. In order to get there, the talk will have two parts. In the first part of the talk, we'll turn on flux through three cycles in a compactification manifold and ask how this affects the vacuum structure of that compactification. In particular, for 2B on the orientifold of a 6-torus, we'll see that turning on NS and RR3 form flux through non-trivial three cycles in the compactification manifold generates a scalar potential that generically lifts all of the moduli. For generic flux, this will break all the supersymmetry, but it's possible to restrict ourselves to more specific choices of flux where we can preserve n equals 0, 1, 2, or 3 supersymmetry, or 4 in the absence of flux. Once we finish on the 2B side, we'll move on to talk about the T-duals. And after motivating why this is an interesting thing to look at, I'll spend some time talking about what exactly the compactification geometries are, what I mean by twisted tori. After that, we'll look in more detail at the case of three T-dualities. This is particularly interesting because Strominger, Yau, and Zaslow have told us that mirror symmetry of Calabi-Yau's can be thought of as T-duality on all three of the all three directions of the T3 fibers. So we'll take a look at that for the case of a torus and raise some questions or make some statements about what we would expect in the Calabi-Yau case. After that, if there's time, we'll also look at supersymmetry, the superpotential, what exactly from an intrinsically 2A point of view we need to have supersymmetry. Now, to try to motivate why this is something that you should care about, why 2B backgrounds with flux are something that you might be interested in, it's useful to compare these n equals 1 2B backgrounds with flux in four dimensions to perturbative heterotic compactifications. So perturbatively, heterotic compactifications leave the Dilton axion, complex structure moduli, Kähler moduli, all unlifted. Is there a pointer here somewhere? Thanks. Now, we know that moduli are bad for a number of reasons. Massless scalar fields that interact only gravitationally, we would see in fifth force experiments. They generate long-range interactions that we just don't observe. They also cause problems in cosmology with, in particular, Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So we want to get rid of these moduli. And in the perturbative heterotic string, you really need to invent some mechanism by hand to get rid of these moduli. It is true that there exist non-perturbative effects in heterotic string theory, like world sheet instantons or wrapped Euclidean 5 brains, NS 5 brains, but it's computationally, the computational difficulties have so far proven insurmountable to really say anything on the heterotic side. I don't think there's a single compact example in which someone has performed these instanton calculations and found a supersymmetric minimum. We'll see that on the 2B backgrounds with flux, you'll be able to be much more explicit about the sorts of stabilization of moduli that take place. World sheet instantons depend upon Kähler moduli, so you'd expect them to lift Kähler moduli. They depend upon the size of the cycles that are being wrapped. Another shortcoming of perturbative heterotic compactifications is that there are low-energy field theory phenomena like Gugino condensation and chiral symmetry breaking that we'd like to understand not only from the field theory point of view but also in string theory. In this context, there really is no string theoretical understanding that differs from the field theory understanding. So string theory doesn't really buy us any additional insight. In contrast, for n equals 1 2B backgrounds with flux, the fluxes generically will lift the dilaton axion, all of the complex structure moduli, and some of the Kähler moduli as well. One of the motivations for the second part of the talk will be to try to lift the remaining Kähler moduli. In addition, we now have connections to holography. Because when we turn these fluxes on, the metric is always that of a warped product with the size of space-time varying over the compact manifold, we can relate physics at different scales in the low-energy effective theory to geometrical phenomena at different locations in the compact manifold. And this is powerful for intuition or even computationally, because in this context, it allows us to relate non-perturbative phenomena in the low-energy effective theory to perturbative phenomena in the higher dimensional gravity theory. So to take the same example of Gugino condensation, Klebanov and Strassler have shown that in one particular model, this scale, the scale of chiral symmetry breaking, is related to the size of a minimal three sphere in the warped deformed conifold. Now, Klebanov and Strassler considered a non-compact local model for the internal manifold. So this Gugino condensation scale, or the size of the three sphere, is a parameter. It's not something that's determined. But Giddings, Kutcher, and Polchinski embedded this warped deformed conifold within an actual compact Calabi-Yau near conifold points in its moduli space of complex structure, and found that, first of all, the size of the three sphere is determined by a perturbative superpotential. And secondly, it's natural for the size of the three sphere to be an exponential in a ratio of fluxes. So this provides a mechanism for an exponential hierarchy between Planck scale and the scale of non-perturbative low energy field theory effects. So having motivated why you might be interested in 2B backgrounds in which we've turned on NSN Raman-Raman three-form flux, I should now also motivate why I would care about this particular torus or antifold. Now, a six torus is the simplest compactification manifold that gets us to four dimensions. The goal is that by choosing the simplest simplest six manifold that admits flux in four dimensions, so we will need an orientifold and not just a torus compactification, we'll be able to compute things much more explicitly than we could for Calabi-Yau orientifolds or for F-theory compactifications. And we'll see that this is the case, that unlike previous results, which relied on an approximate analysis near singular points, near conifold points in the moduli space of complex structure, here we'll be able to compute the superpotential and deflatness conditions explicitly and globally on the moduli space of the torus. But before we specialize just to the torus or antifold, I thought I would show you a picture of just what this class of models is in general, this class of orientifolds with flux. So generically, we would have some compactification manifold, six manifold. And if there are non-trivial three cycles in that manifold, we can turn on NS or Raman-Raman three-form flux through those three cycles. So H is always the NS flux, F is the Raman-Raman flux. In addition, we would have space-filling D3 brains at points in the compactification manifold, space-filling orientifold planes, and in the case of F-theory, we could also have seven brains, possibly with instantons turned on in the compact parts of their whirl volumes. Now, for consistency, there's a tadpole cancellation condition that tells us that the total D3 brain charge has to vanish. And all of these objects have D3 brain charge. For the fluxes, the D3 brain charge and tension comes from non-vanishing H wedge F. For the D3 brains in orientifold planes, it's the usual story. The orientifold planes just have negative D3 brain charge, negative D3 brain tension. In the F theory case, you induce D3 brain charge and tension if you have these instantons on the whirl volume. In addition, in F theory, the Euler character of the compactification manifold contributes. So you could do a lot of model building if you wanted to with all of these ingredients. But from now on, we will restrict to the simplest case that the compact manifold is a torus. And since we want to turn on the fluxes, we also need at least orientifold planes by tadpole cancellation. So here are the definitions of the torus or antifold. We take the coordinates to be periodic with period 1. And then we mod out by this Z2 operation, the product of world sheet parity, reflection on the T6, and left moving fermion parity. So the first two should be pretty straightforward. The third piece, this left-moving fermion parity, is required by supersymmetry. If you don't include it, you can still do this orientable projection, but the space-time fields won't fill out supersymmetry or supergravity multiplets. So if you'd like to preserve any supersymmetry at all, you need this third piece in the orientable operation. And this might not look familiar, but it really is something that you know very well in disguise. It's related to type 1 by 6 T-dualities, T-dualities in all of the torus directions. So under that T-duality, the 16 D9s of type 1 that give you the SO32 gauge group become 16 D3 brains on the torus orientifold. The charge and tension of those D3 brains is canceled by 64 orientifold planes at the fixed points of that Z2. And so the low energy field theory is the familiar SO32 n equals 4 supergravity mills, coupled to n equals 4 supergravity. But that's not the most general solution. So as I said, qualitatively, there's a tadpole cancellation. So this is a quantitative statement of the tadpole cancellation condition. It tells us that the total D3 brain charge has to vanish. So in terms of the number of orientable planes, number of D3 brains, and the fluxes, this is the condition that you see here. This tells us that wedged fluxes contribute to tadpole cancellation in the same way as the number of D3 brains does. And in fact, this term here is quantized due to the quantization conditions on the NSNR fluxes. So it's quantized in integer units in the same way as the number of D3 brains is. And in addition, it's strictly positive definite when the fluxes preserve a subset of supersymmetries that a D3 brain preserves, negative when the fluxes preserve a subset of the supersymmetries that an anti-D3 brain preserves. So the wedge fluxes really are, in almost all ways, like D3 brains. Now, in the absence of fluxes, we satisfy the tadpole cancellation condition with 16 D brains, 64 orientifold planes. But it's clear that we can trade off D3 brains for wedged fluxes and still satisfy the tadpole cancellation condition. And this is what we'll explore over the next 15 minutes before we get to the second part of the talk. The one way in which the analogy isn't exact is that whereas D3 brains preserve n equals 4 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions, the fluxes preserve less. So part of the goal of the first part of the talk will also be to determine the precise conditions on the fluxes to preserve the various amounts of supersymmetry. The fields in 4 dimensions descend from the fields in the 10-dimensional 2B supergravity multiplet. So the bosonic fields in the 10D multiplet are the metric Neveu-Schwartz B field and dilaton axion, or dilaton in the NS sector, and 3 Raman-Raman potentials. Under the Z2 that I wrote down a couple of transparencies ago, the fields transform in the way that I've shown in this table. And it's very easy to write down the table. The first column you know because you know which fields you have in type 1. So the first column just tells you what you have in type 1. Second column just tells you NS or RR sector. And if you remember, there was a third part of the Z2. The third part, the sign of the third part is just determined by how many indices the particular fields have in the internal coordinate directions. So it's easy from the table to read off which fields are preserved, or which fields are projected in under this orientifold operation. We have the 4-dimensional graviton. We also have 38 scalars. And we have 12 U1 gauge fields. Now, I said that we wanted to turn on fluxes in the compact manifold. So you notice that you don't see an NS or Raman-Raman two-form field with both legs in the compact directions. They're projected out, but it is consistent with the orientifold operation to turn on the fluxes. So the one thing to note is that, or the two things to note are that the choice of the fluxes is not a continuous choice. It's discrete because the fluxes have a Dirac quantization condition. And also, the fluxes are non-dynamical because of what I said a second ago. The corresponding potentials are projected out.
Yeah. You're saying that the potentials are not there, but the build strengths are?
Yeah. You can think of it as...
what does that mean?
Yeah.
They're not closed anymore?
No, they are closed. The potentials are non-dynamical. So it is true. I make some ansatz in which, as I'll get to in the second part of the talk, these two-form fields have some vev, and then they have a fluctuating part. And the vev is such that it gives a flux, and the fluctuating part is projected out.
The zero mode.
The zero mode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's still the quids of climate.
Yeah, everything that I say will be at the level of supergravity. I'm not going to be concerned with the higher Kaluza-Klein fields or the higher string excitations. And I'll justify the validity of that approximation.
But these fluxes will still be translationally invariant around the torus. These are not.
Yeah, these fluxes will be translationally invariant around the torus.
The potential is just linear.
The potential is linear. Something that won't be so important in the first part of the talk, but that will be in the second, is that it's an example of a Shirk-Schwarz compactification. You instead of just taking the fields to be independent of the compact directions, you give them some particular dependence, factorizable dependence on the internal coordinates. Okay. The fields on the previous transparency can be organized into n equals 4 supergravity multiplets. N equals 4 is the amount of supersymmetry that's preserved before the fluxes are turned on. So those supergravity multiplets are one gravity multiplet, six vector multiplets. So all of the scalars, with the exception of the dilaton axion, are in the vector multiplets. But half of the vectors are in the vector multiplets, half in the gravity multiplet. Now, if we don't saturate the tadpole cancellation condition with the fluxes, then we also need D3 brains. And each D3 brain will give an additional n equals 4 vector multiplet. But this doesn't really add anything essential for our purposes. So we'll ignore or suppress these additional vector multiplets in the rest of the story. Now, if we turn on fluxes, we can ask what this corresponds to in the low-energy field theory. And what it corresponds to is generating a potential that lifts the scalars, that lifts the moduli, and also turning on charges that couple those scalar fields to the 12 U1 gauge fields. So the result is a supersymmetric Higgs mechanism in which n equals 4 is broken to something smaller. And the specifics of this super Higgs mechanism were written up in a paper by Ferrara and collaborators. Okay, so yeah, lots of equations. This is the most equation-rich transparency, but it's really not so bad. The scalar potential, the thing that lifts the moduli, descends from the kinetic terms for the three-form field strengths in the 10-dimensional 2B supergravity action. Now, there are two different three-form fields, NS, or Raman-Raman and NS, but it's convenient to combine them into one complex three-form field, NS, or Raman-Raman minus dilaton axion NS. So from now on, phi stands for the dilaton axion, not just the dilaton. The usefulness of this definition is that for one thing, G has nice transformation properties under SL2, and for another thing, for the rest of this transparency will be useful. Now, the one other thing we have to do to cast this in a meaningful form is decompose this complex three-form field strength into eigenstates of the Hodge-Star operator. So in six dimensions, the Hodge-Star squares to -1, and its eigenvalues are therefore plus or minus I. Corresponding eigenstates are imaginary self-dual or imaginary anti-self-dual. In terms of these definitions, we can write this compact part of the kinetic term, which becomes the scalar potential, as the sum of two terms. The first term is a topological term. So just as this can also be written as something times integral h wedge f. Just as h wedge f gave us a D3 brain charge, it also gives us a D3 brain tension. This is the D3 brain tension from the fluxes. And it cancels with the tension of the oriental planes and any space-filling D3 brains that are present. The other piece from those kinetic terms defines the scalar potential. It's just the imaginary anti-self-dual part of the flux squared. So we learn that the scalar potential is minimized and equal to zero when the flux is purely imaginary self-dual. Now, we to minimize the potential, we do not continuously vary the fluxes. The fluxes are a discrete choice. They are non-dynamical. Instead, the various moduli enter into this potential through the dependence of G on the dilaton axion and through the metric dependence of the Hodge star. That depends upon Kähler and complex structure moduli. So we can expect this scalar potential to lift the various, or some subset of the Kähler and complex structure moduli or the dilaton axion. A couple of other things to note are that this scalar potential is positive semi-definite. And there's a supergravity interpretation of this in terms of no-scale structure. The low-energy supergravity for these orientifolds is a no-scale supergravity. And what that means in caricature is that the supergravity scalar potential is related to the superpotential as I've written here. There's the usual dW squared that you have in global supersymmetry, but then there's this minus W squared term. And in no-scale models, the dW squareds from the Kähler moduli cancel with the minus 3W squareds, leaving a sum over other moduli that's manifestly positive definite. So that's the origin of the positive definiteness in the scalar potential. And then another point that I mentioned a little bit ago is that as long as we choose the scale of this potential, the mass scale of this scalar potential, it follows from the Dirac quantization conditions on the fluxes. It turns out that the fluxes are quantized in units of alpha prime, and the fluxes are integrated over three cycles, so you find that the mass scale of the potential is alpha prime over r cubed. As long as we take this typical size of the torus to be, of cycles in the torus, to be large in string units, then this mass scale is much smaller than the Kaluza-Klein scale and the string scale, which justifies neglecting the higher Kaluza-Klein excitations and string excitations in the low-energy effective field theory. Now, if we'd like to preserve at least n equals 1 supersymmetry, it isn't enough to just minimize the potential. We need to require that the Dilatino variation and at least one of the Gravitino variations vanishes. And from Grania and Polchinski, we know that this implies that G has to be of type 2-1 and it has to be primitive. The definition of primitivity is that a form is primitive if it's annihilated by the Kähler form. Now, it turns out that 2-1 and primitivity together implies imaginary self-dual. So if these conditions are satisfied, the scalar potential is automatically minimized. Now, in the case of a Calabi-Yau compactification, the conditions follow from a superpotential that was written down by the Beckers, Gokov-Wafa-Witten, and Giddings, Kaczor-Polchinski. For a Calabi-Yau, this actually only imposes the 2-1 condition. There are no five forms in a Calabi-Yau, so J wedge any three form vanishes, and the primitivity condition is trivial. But for the torus, we do have non-primitive three forms that I've written here. So the way that the story is modified is that in addition to the superpotential, we have D terms as well. But for our purpose in this talk, we won't be concerned with the precise structure of these D terms. So we'll concentrate on the superpotential, and then when we need to impose primitivity, we'll just do that by hand. Now, in our paper, we weren't able to classify all n equals 1, n equals 2, or other flux vacuum, we were able to obtain large classes of solutions. I thought, though, that it might be more interesting for all of you to just pick one example and work that out in detail. And in this example, I've tried to illustrate both generic and non-generic features of these supersymmetric vacua. So we'll take this particular choice of fluxes expressed in terms of integral three forms, since the fluxes are quantized. And we also need to parameterize the complex structure of the torus. So what we'll do is, instead of writing dz equals dx plus idy, we write the complex structure in terms of a period matrix. This is the generalization of the dx plus tau dy for a two torus. And it's called the period matrix because these are the integral one cycles, and this is a holomorphic one form. So if you integrate the holomorphic one form over an integral cycle, you get a period of that holomorphic one form over a cycle. That's the origin of the name. In terms of this definition of complex structure, the holomorphic three form is just the product of the DZs. Now, we also need to parameterize the Kähler form, and here I've just written the most general 1-1 form. Both rho and tau have certain positivity conventions and discrete identifications, but none of that really adds anything to the story, so we'll gloss over that here. Okay. Now, with these definitions, we can take the superpotential that I wrote on the previous transparency and wedge the appropriate three forms together, and in a half a page of algebra, obtain an explicit polynomial expression for the superpotential. So here, cof is the cofactor. This is the subdeterminant if you cross out the third row and third column. So if we had tried to do this for something like a Calabi-Yau, we might have been able to compute the periods. If we would have been able to, it would have been in terms of complicated hypergeometric functions, and we would have been hard-pressed to just differentiate and find and minimize this superpotential. But here for the torus, we have this nice explicit polynomial expression, so it's very easy to find the solutions to the supersymmetric equations of motion. So from that superpotential, it's easy to take the superpotential on the previous transparency, differentiate, and these capital D's are Kähler covariant derivatives in the Kähler geometry of the moduli space, and either the fact that the superpotential was independent of the Kähler moduli, or the fact that there was no scale structure, which guarantees that dW is proportional to W for the Kähler moduli, we find from the Kähler moduli that the superpotential has to vanish. Once we know that, these covariant derivatives just become ordinary partial derivatives. The connection piece drops out. So we learn that these derivatives of the superpotential have to vanish. So sparing you the details, we differentiate that superpotential in the previous transparency. And what we find is that the complex structure, the period matrix, has to be diagonal, and that there are two constraints involving the period matrix and the dilaton axion. So the complex structure moduli space, and I'll include the dilaton axion as a complex structure modulus, is two complex dimensional parameterized by phi and tau 1-1 if I want. Now, using these constraints, we can express the fluxes in terms of holomorphic forms instead of in terms of integral forms. When we do that, we find that it's some function of the moduli times this form. So the things to note here are that this form is of type 2-1, two holomorphic, one anti-holomorphic, one form. So we can check off the first condition for supersymmetry. And it's also primitive for a six-dimensional subspace of Kähler moduli. You can check that if these constraints on the Kähler moduli are satisfied, then J which G vanishes. So we've satisfied both conditions for supersymmetry, and this flux preserves at least n equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. Now, this example is also non-generic in the following sense. Given, well, if we interchange z1 and z1 bar, and at the same time z2 and z2 bar, then the flux is still primitive and it's still 2-1. In fact, in this case, it's invariant. So another way of saying that is that given one particular choice of complex structure, there exists a different complex structure such that the conditions for supersymmetry are still satisfied. This is exactly the condition for n equals 2 supersymmetry. Similarly, if there were three different complex structures such that the conditions for n equals 1 were still satisfied, there'd be n equals 3 supersymmetry. And Andrew Fry and Joe have written a paper about this, telling us about these n equals 3 solutions.
So this has some extra plateau reference.
Yeah, so this, right. And that's what we'll talk about on the next transparency, the counting in general of how many moduli we'll have. But that's right. It has two complex flat directions and then six complex flat directions for the Kähler moduli, so a total of 8.
How many are different from the one?
How many are lifted? All. So the other 7 complex structure moduli, and or 8 because it was complex structure moduli plus dilaton, and then 3 Kähler moduli. Okay. So having worked out one example in detail, it's natural to ask what we would expect in general. And here you can learn a lot just by counting equations and unknowns. So altogether, we had 11 equations, but the Kähler moduli didn't enter at all into these equations. So there were 11 equations in the 10 complex moduli, dilaton axion and the complex structure moduli. So there are more equations than unknowns, and generically we wouldn't expect to find any solutions to the supersymmetry equations of motion. But it's also true that if the equations aren't all independent, then we would expect to find a solution by counting. And we can arrange that the equations are redundant by a particular choice, or special choice of flux. So if we arrange for exactly one redundancy, we expect to find n equals 1 supersymmetry, and we expect all complex structure moduli to be lifted generically. If we arrange for an even greater redundancy, then we expect not to lift all the moduli, to have a space of solutions. And whenever we preserve greater than n equals 1 supersymmetry, we expect this to be the case. The counting for Kähler moduli just comes from the permittivity condition. So J is a Kähler form. There are 9 real Kähler moduli, or 9 complex moduli, once you include the axionic part of the Kähler modulus. If we have at least n equals 1 supersymmetry, G is a 2-1 form. So J wedged G is a 3-2 form, the space of which is complex dimension 6. So from counting, we have 9 equations, 6 unknowns. We expect 3 complex Kähler moduli after the permittivity conditions are imposed. So you can show that this, if that wasn't enough to convince you, it is true that you can show that the generic n equals 1 case is that you do lift all complex structure moduli and you do lift 6 of the 9 Kähler moduli. It's not true always. There are n equals 1 solutions with more moduli, but it is the generic case. But the counting fails. I told you already why it fails for the complex structure moduli when you have more supersymmetry. For the Kähler moduli, the reason it fails is that if you preserve n equals 2 or more supersymmetry, then you've restricted the possible values of G. So J wedge G, as you let J vary, is not going to sweep out all of H3-2. And it's not going to be true that you generically find only 3 Kähler moduli at the end. But the important thing to get out of this transparency and out of this first part of the talk, and the second part I'll make sure is condensed a little bit so that we get through it all, is that the generic supersymmetric case, now not generically you don't have any supersymmetry at all, but once you say that you do have some supersymmetry, the generic case is n equals 1 with all complex structure moduli lifted and with 6 of the 9 Kähler moduli lifted as well. Okay. So now we'll move on to talk about the theories that are t-dual to these theories. Now, why might you want to do this? Why might you want to study the t-duals? Well, the reason that we initially wanted to study the t-duals is that we found that we lifted generically all of the complex structure moduli, but not all of the Kähler moduli. So you could ask, what can you do to lift the Kähler moduli? Well, we know that mirror symmetry interchanges Kähler and complex structure moduli. And we also know that there's a similar superpotential in 2A that involves the NS flux that should lift complex structure moduli. So we might expect that by turning on this dual flux, we lift Kähler moduli in the original 2B theory. Now, the reason to study t-duality is that there is a relationship between mirror symmetry and t-duality. You can interpret mirror symmetry as t-duality on T3 fibers. Now, if we want to know what the, if we want to ask anything about the, what kind of degree of freedom this might correspond to turning on in the original 2B theory, turning on this dual flux, we know that t-duality mixes or interchanges NS flux with metric. So you might expect that we somehow missed in the original 2B orientifold another discrete degree of freedom that corresponds to doing something geometrical. So there might be geometrical terms missing in the 2B superpotential. Now, actually, this turns out not to be the case. It turns out that in the original orientifold, we didn't miss anything. The sorts of twists, geometrical twists that you might, discrete things that you might want to turn on, are projected out by the 2B orientifold operation. So we do have the whole story in 2B. But before arriving at this conclusion, we did some, you know, we transformed the original fluxes and metric into the dual fluxes and metric, and what you find is that you have geometry that is not it's not usually Calabi-Yau, it's not Kähler, it is possibly not even complex. So these compactifications, for geometrical reasons, are interesting in their own right as a class of new compactifications that do not involve the usual compactification manifolds. And some other references, non-Kähler compactifications have also been studied by Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Sethi, and recently by Katrin Becker and Kishap Dasgupta.
It's not as possible because when you go down to the small radii, the warping gets very large, and
yeah,
you have translation invariances that don't know the t-dual. So is there a trick, or are you lucky somehow?
Okay. So, yeah, you could have complained about the warping in the first part of my talk also, which I didn't say anything about. Now, in the limit that the radius of the torus is very large, you can make the warp factor very, very close to 1 and push it as close to the orientifold planes as you want. It's true that the orientifold planes break translational invariance. And it's a warping, it's not the orientable
place.
Right.
I think in the first part of your talk, it's okay because the Dukhov-Popper-Witten superpotential doesn't feel the warp factor, and that you're examining conditions that come from that.
Yeah.
In this case.
But when you get the dual, I don't know how to directly find the t-dual geometry. Are you going to talk more about that?
I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about these geometries. Okay. But you can complain again at the appropriate point. So first, without getting involved in the gory detail of the t-dualities of the actual 2B vacua that we discussed in the first part of the talk, really everything is embodied in the simple example of a T3 with NS flux through it. So we'll just take some time to talk about this T3 with NS flux. Now, the Boucher rules tell us how to transform NS potentials into metric and vice versa. What happens to the metric and NSB field under t-duality? So in a nutshell, what we expect is if we start with 2B, a flat T3 in the compactification manifold, I'm not going to worry about satisfying Tadpole cancellation conditions, we're just going to focus on this T3, and NS flux through that 3 torus, after a t-duality, we expect the NS flux to go into some twisting of the T3, and we expect the flatness of the geometry beforehand to go into vanishing NS flux afterwards. So a little more quantitatively, how that happens is, if we start off with a T3 in three directions that I'll call X, Y, and Z, and we turn on n units of NS flux through that three torus, and for simplicity, we'll just take a square, a cubic metric, then making a particular gauge choice for the NS potential, we can apply the Boucher rules and write down the dual geometry and the T-dual flux. So the dual geometry looks a lot like the original T3, except there's this extra piece, this extra NXDY. And as we expected as up there, there is no flux or potential in after doing the T-duality. Now, the first thing that we can infer, yeah?
So how does this solve the Sturm equations of motion? Are you playing R off of R squared terms in the action?
No.
Okay.
So there's T-duality at the level of conformal field theory, and there's also T-duality at the level of supergravity.
Yeah.
But what I'll do is I will show you, or no, I guess I will not show you, but I can tell you as a fact that it's possible to, at least for the n equals 2 example, which I'll T-dualize in a couple of minutes, it's possible to show that after doing the T-duality, it's always possible to choose the moduli in such a way that the radii are all large and the string coupling is small so that the supergravity approximation is valid.
What,
so
is
the two
Ritchie T... Flat? Is that Ritchie flat?
No, this metric is not Ritchie flat.
Okay, so...
But there... No, oh, in this particular example, I'm not attempting to satisfy the equations of motion. I'm just focusing on this T3. It will be embedded in a six manifold that does satisfy the string equations of motion together with fluxes.
And you're saying that in the end that will be Ritchie flat, or is it, does it solve the string equations of motion by playing R off of R squared?
It solves the string equations of motion by, well, involving, there are still going to be Raman fluxes, so it's going to be a non-Ricci flat geometry with Raman flux. But to also get a little ahead of myself, I don't want to spoil the punchline, so I won't say it just yet. But there is a way in which these might be related to Ricci flat manifolds. Okay. But the very first thing that you can infer, looking at this metric, is that if you want the metric to be well-defined, if these one forms that appear in the metric are going to be well-defined, then you can't just choose this. The periodic identifications that define the twisted torus are not the same as those that define the flat torus. This particular one form, if you want this one form to be globally well-defined, then just by writing it in two different ways, you see that if you go around the X cycle by one unit, then you're not going to be identifying Z with Z, but with Z with Z minus NY instead. So there's this twisted identification. Okay. Now, we'd like to be very precise about what exactly is there some direct thing that the NS flux maps to in the dual geometry with the least amount of transformations as possible. And we'll see that it's the spin connection. Really, it's a one-to-one map. The NS flux transforms into spin connection after doing the T-duality. We also, because T-duality interchanges momentum and winding, we expect the NS flux beforehand to somehow be related to Kaluza-Klein flux after doing the T-duality. Momentum is Kaluza-Klein charge. So, we'll make all that precise. So probably when you first stare at that metric, the first interpretation that pops out at you is to think of it as a torus fibered over a circle. This part here looks like a torus metric where the complex structure, it depends upon the base coordinate instead of being constant. But there is another way we can interpret this metric, and that's as a circle bundle or a U1 principal bundle over a two torus. So S1 over T2 instead of T2 over S1. This is the form of the metric for a U1 bundle, and this is exactly the same as the form of the metric that we found after T-duality. So in this case, the connection is just this NXDY piece, and that has the interpretation as the U1 connection, or the Kaluza-Klein gauge field. So this shows how we can read off right from the metric that NS flux has been transformed into KK flux. Now, even a more direct correspondence than that is that once you have a spin connection one form, you can always turn that into a three form. It has three indices. You can anti-symmetrize on all of them. That's basically what this says. The components of this are the anti-symmetrized spin connection. You can show that the anti-symmetrized spin connection on this twisted three torus is just exactly the same as that NS flux that you had beforehand. And both of these, the Kaluza-Klein field strength and the spin connection part, are both things that hold very generally. If you've done some number of T-dualities, then if these were the isometry directions, the spin connection just ends up having pieces from all of these Kaluza-Klein fluxes. And also this previous statement is true, that the NS flux is just going to pieces of the spin connection.
Eta's and basis one form?
The eta's
are basis one form?
Yeah, the eta's were the things that appeared in the metric. They're the field bind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basis. Right. Okay. So let me just say a couple of words about how this would be realized in the actual G-dual geometries. So that was a twisted three torus. More generally, the higher dimensional twisted tori would involve, well, they'd be a metric with these basis one forms, where the basis one forms are of this form. Instead of the dz plus nxdy, we have this generalization of that. And if we've done T-dualities in, well, the gammas are only going to be non-zero for certain components. So if we did one T-duality, it's only going to be, if we did it in the 9 direction, it would only be gamma 9 and then not 9 that are non-zero. We did T-dualities in a couple directions, it would only be the T-duality directions, non-T-duality directions that are non-zero. Now, on the 2B side, we had a superpotential that was this, that involved a piece from the NS flux, the flux wedge omega. There was an integral G wedge omega in 2B. So what you find on the 2A side is that you have the spin connection appears in the superpotential. The superpotential maps very directly to this integral of NS flux minus spin connection wedge omega. It's not very difficult to include the RR fluxes as well. They just transform under T-duality by adding a component or losing a component. So we won't say anything about them right now. But let me say one more thing and then, yeah. But you can see why we can't turn on twisting in 2B, in the original 2B orientifold. In the original 2B orientifold, we reflected on all of the six torus directions. So these dx's are all odd, and these xdx's are all even. So there are no one forms that involve gamma non-zero that have a definite parity under the orientifold operation. If we do have done any t-dualities, then the orientifold operation projects or reflects not all of the torus directions. So then there are some even and some odd x's and dx's, and we can turn on twisting, turn on gammas, consistent with the orientable projection. Yeah.
Okay, so now I think this is part of the answer to my question, because yeah. The superpotential goes like the spin connection. So let me see. That means that comes from something like an R squared term.
Yeah, right, that's right.
Okay.
Okay.
So what you'd like to do is say that in the same way that the integral g wedge omega superpotential gave rise to a scalar potential g squared,
right,
that here, yeah, this spin connection gives rise to the Einstein-Hilbert term in the compact directions.
Oh, Einstein-Hilbert or R squared?
No, Einstein-Hilbert, actually. Yeah. Now, actually, but
I thought if you take, say, the h squared term in the action, on the 2b side, that's a derivative of b.
Yeah.
And then you dualize it, and you should get something. Well, and b goes to spin connection, and so db should go to curvature, and so db squared should go to curvature squared. Now, is that naive reasoning at all?
I thought b went to metric, and so.
And you can also, if you want, write down the Einstein-Hilbert term in terms of the spin connection, and it is quadratic in the spin connection.
Okay, so this spin connection squared, which is part of the curvature function.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you just turn on an S flux in the dual, and then you go over, then you have something that's, it is Ricci flat.
Well, if I could just turn on NS flux in the dual,
You say you can't find solutions of the string equations with just NS flux in curvature.
I don't think that you can. I'm going to skip a couple of things. So anything that you could do with one t-duality, you can also do with more than one t-duality. But there is a caveat. So in about a month, Brooke will tell you about this caveat. But basically the problem is this. If you have, say, this is fixed ijk. If some component of h is non-zero, and you try to t-dualize in two of the directions appearing in the legs instead of just one, then you don't have a well-defined compactification manifold. If I had told you about Shirk-Schwarz, I could tell you that there are monodromies that mix the metric moduli with NS moduli. So this in a limited context is illustrated here. So if we focus on this three torus again, in particular on the viewing this as a, even though it's a trivial vibration, a T2 vibration over an S1, then we know that in string theory you have u-duality groups. Even geometrically, you have discrete identifications of the moduli space of the metric. So if we focused on a T2 and complexified a scalar modulus to include an NSB field, then in string theory, we would have a duality group relating equivalent choices of all of these moduli, the complex structure moduli on the fiber and the Kähler modulus on the fiber. So that duality group for 2 tori would be O22, which, just like you can think of the Lorentz group as being SU2 times SU2, here you can think of it as being SL2 times SL2. And the familiar SL2 for the modular parameter of the torus, and also an SL2 for the Kähler modulus. Now, the sort of twisting that you start out with when you have this B field is not a geometrical twisting, it's a Shirk-Schwarz twisting of flux. The potential is not single valued, it comes back to itself such that this axion of the Kähler modulus goes around once. So the Shirk-Schwarz monodromy associated with this NSB potential is just a shift in the U1 in that SL2, an axionic shift. If we do one T duality, then we end up with this metric that I wrote down a second ago. So in this case, it's the complex structure modulus that goes through one SL2 shift in going around the base of the fibration. But if we do two T dualities, and this was one of the subjects of Brooks' paper, then what happens is it's again a menagerie in the Kähler modulus, but the Kähler modulus after two T dualities is one over the original Kähler modulus. So it's a menagerie that mixes both it's a twist that mixes the metric and the B field. So the metric alone is not something that's single valued. It looks like the volume doesn't come back to itself after one cycle around the base torus, or the base S1. So we'll in our paper and in the brief remainder of this talk, we won't talk about these sorts of non-geometrical compactifications, and we'll always make sure we do T dualities that don't give us this problem. Okay, so if we start off with that the particular example flux that I chose in the first part of the talk, then in 2B, this saturates the tadpole cancellation conditions. We have no D3 brains. We do have the orientable planes. If we T-dualize once using the Boucher rules, then we end up with... Actually, that'll be on the next transparency. So the bottom of this transparency is something that I said a second ago, or 15 minutes ago. If we write the metric for a flat torus before T-duality in this form, then and choose diagonal complex structure and Kähler moduli, then the complex structure moduli are just ratios of the x and y radii, and the Kähler moduli are products of the x and y radii. So under T-duality, all that happens is that one of the radius directions gets flipped. So it's possible to translate these constraints in Kähler and complex structure moduli into the dual theory. And it's possible to satisfy the constraints that we had in the original 2B theory while still keeping string coupling small and radius small.
In the original string theory, the dual time was required to be 1. Not here.
It wasn't. Because for the n equals 2 example, it was allowed to...
Oh, you say in this case you have a dual time that actually is not fixed.
Right.
In the n equals 3 cases, it's fixed. In the n equals 2,
it's fixed in the n equals 3 cases.
It's fixed in the n equals 3 cases. I see. So that's important. So because you say you have some freedom to vary the dilaton in the original compactification.
Yeah. So it's not true that the original and the dual will both be valid at the same time.
Right.
But it is true that that there's a string theory duality and that any one supergravity description will be valid. So, but we're, for the purposes of a presentation here, I'm not going to keep track of those things. You'll just have to trust me that you can, after each T-duality, still arrange for each of these radii to be large and the string coupling to be small. So for simplicity, we'll just take all the X radii and the Y radii to be the same, and we'll choose this particular gauge that gave the NS fluxes on the previous transparency. There were two non-zero components of NS flux, two non-zero components of Raman-Raman flux. So there are three T-dualities that we can do where we don't run into the caveat that I mentioned earlier. And after one T-duality, we get this six-dimensional metric, which you can see has the twisted three-torus metric embedded in it. It's just a twisted three-torus crossed with other circles. But something that you should notice, which you would have seen if I had discussed Schurk-Schwarz, so let me give you a very quick argument for why this is true, is this compact manifold has an odd first Betti number. It has only 5 one forms, so it can't possibly be a Kähler manifold, and this is a generic feature of these dual geometries. In general, we don't expect them to be Kähler manifolds. The way that you can see very quickly that H1 is 5 is that for the twisted three torus, I start with three winding directions, but I don't have any isometries for two reasons. One, the oriental plane breaks the isometries if this is embedded in the oriental, and two, NS flux breaks isometries. You have NS flux through a three torus at the quantum mechanical level. You don't have any isometries. All the classical isometries are broken by world sheet instantons. So what happens after T-duality is a T-duality interchanges momentum and windings and isometries. So instead of having all three windings on the twisted three torus, you have only two windings, but you gain an isometry direction. So here in this more realistic situation that you have the six manifold from the supersymmetric duality of the supersymmetric 2B background, instead of two rather than three, you have five rather than six 1 cycles. So that's why it's non-Kähler. And you still have some NS flux that you haven't transformed into geometry, and you've either lost or added a leg to the Raman flux. Now, after two T-dualities, we find that we don't have any NS flux at all. We've completely gotten rid of the NS field, and we've turned it completely into geometry. It sort of looks like two twisted three tori that make up the twisted T6, except that not really, they're both combined with each other since they both depend on that X3. And now there's only Raman-Raman three-form flux. Oh, and I should also have said that the orientable planes after T-duality just like D-brains will either add or lose a dimension, the orientable planes will keep adding a dimension.
So we should have been able to find these solutions from the original system
of equation? No, because it's not the same orientable we started with. It's an orientable that reflects R4 and not R6. But we should have been able to see them at some level from the supergravity equations in 2B.
Yeah.
With taking into account the orientable plane charge. Okay, and then after three dualities, the mirror has the third duality that we do is there was no NS flux, so we don't get any more twisting. All we end up doing is flipping this other radius, but we do add or remove legs to the flux. So what you find for the mirror is that you have only two-form Raman-Raman flux, and then you have this twisted six torus. Oh, and these O6 planes as well. The O3 planes after three T-dualities became O6 planes. So this metric is not Ricci flat. It has curvature, let alone Ricci curvature. And you'd be tempted to describe it by just saying that there are two independent T2 vibrations, one in which the X1, X3 torus has a monogamy over X2. There's the X2 dependence. And the other one where this other two torus has a monogamy over Y2. There's another way that you can encode this information. And the other way that you can encode that information is you can instead talk about an SL3Z monogamy over a base a three torus. And this is related to the fact that you could view T2 vibrations over S1 as S1 vibrations over T2. So the difference between this and the original geometry is that you have some twisting of the T3 fibers. So it's interesting to ask whether this is also the case for mirror duals of Calabi-Yau's where you have NS flux. Is it also true there that you can encode all of the geometrical dual of that NS flux as something that happens to the monogamies in the T3 fibers? After this transparency, I'll conclude. There's something else interesting though about that mirror dual geometry, and that's that the mirror dual geometry involved only two form flux. So we had the manifold was T3 vibration over T3. We had some two form flux, O6 planes, 8 moduli, same number of moduli as before the T dualities, but one-form flux in 2A comes from the M-theory metric. It's or two-form flux, one-form potential, comes from the M-theory metric. It's Kaluza-Klein flux. So all of these things lift only to geometrical quantities in M theory. There's no flux. This should correspond only to a purely geometrical M theory compactification. Its M theory lift should be purely geometrical. The Kaluza-Klein flux just goes into a twisting in the metric, completely analogous to the twistings that we saw above. So the M theory S1 will be twisted over, in this case, the base T3, because that's what directions this A1 is non-zero in. And then the O6 planes also lift geometrically to M theory. They lift to negative charge Atiyah-Hitchens spaces. And these are the directions in which those Atiyah-Hitchens spaces are. Basically, the directions transverse to the O6 planes. So the lift of this should be some smooth seven-dimensional manifold where, and if I took into account the dilaton profile, that would also enter into the metric. The lift of this is a smooth 7D manifold. It preserves n equals 2 supersymmetry. It's just somehow obtained by gluing together these Atiyah-Hitchens spaces and then fibering a T3 over them and twisting an S1 in the Atiyah-Hitchens spaces. So it's some qualitative description of a compactification of M theory that gives you n equals 2. It must be up to some discrete identification, Calabi-Yau across a circle. So we don't understand what these manifolds are any further than this at this point, but it's interesting to ask to try to characterize them.
Why Calabi-Yau?
Well, n equals 2. So if you want n equals 2 compactification of 2b, 2a.
It's not a direct product, is it? I mean, the circle is changing as you move around.
This is not the same circle.
Oh, okay.
So if I ignore all this and I say I have n equals 2, that tells me that I've compactified M theory on either Calabi-Yau across a circle or maybe some discrete identification of that.
Okay, I see.
But if I want to then identify these two things, what that tells me is these twisted tori are really just the same M theory compactifications that we always knew about, but I just picked a weird circle. I didn't pick this circle. I picked some circle like in the T3 fiber or some circle inside the Calabi-Yau in some fibration interpretation of the Calabi-Yau. But it's not a homology cycle. It's not a homologically non-trivial cycle. As far as contractibility, I don't know. If there are torsion classes, there can be cycles that are non-contractible, but that don't lift to real homology classes. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But if it is a Calabi-Yau, then it's a Calabi-Yau with a very low number of moduli, because we only had 8 moduli. So it's a Calabi-Yau either with 8 moduli or maybe some multiple of that if there's a discrete identification of this Calabi-Yau cross circle. And similarly, in n equals 1 examples, if we can find examples, which I think we can, where, it would be hard to do this with n equals 1 because generically you would fix the dilaton. I think there are examples where you don't have the generic number of n equals 1 moduli, and you can play around with the moduli in the same way to keep the supergravity description valid. So for these n equals 1 compactifications, you'd have a similar story where now instead of CY cross S1, you have a G2 manifold. So these would just be some dual description of G2 compactifications. So I think that there I'll conclude. Okay, so let's just summarize what we learned. So in the beginning of the first part of the talk, we saw that by turning on NSN Raman-Raman flux through non-trivial 3 cycles in the 6 torus orientifold, that if we did that, we could solve the supersymmetric equations of motion to find vacua with n equals 0 through 3 supersymmetry, or n equals 4 if we didn't turn the fluxes on. We also saw that you didn't always necessarily have to be in the generic case, but for the generic case, you lifted all the complex structure moduli, including dilaton axion, and 6 of the 9 Kähler moduli as well. And then in the second part of the talk, we explored the T-dual descriptions. We saw that the T-dual descriptions involved manifolds that weren't Calabi-Yau or Kähler, And if I had more time to talk about supersymmetry and complex structure, I would have also shown you that in the most obvious complex structure, they're not complex either. So we saw that the T-dual descriptions involve these exotic manifolds. We also saw that the non-Calabi-Yau-ness of the mirror dual could be encoded in the monodromies of the T3 fiber. And it's natural to ask whether this is the case for Calabi-Yau's as well. And finally, in the case that the mirror only has two-form flux, there's a purely geometrical M-theory lift involving either Calabi-Yau manifold or a G2 in some other formulation. So it would be interesting to characterize these compactification manifolds. And we didn't talk about complex structure and supersymmetry, but we would have seen that we need some work there as well, that the natural complex structures are almost complex structures and not integral complex structures. And it would be nice to know whether there does exist a complex structure for these compactification manifolds. It doesn't look like there are any other degrees of freedom to lift moduli in the original theory, but something that wasn't obvious to us was that the T-dual theories are not exactly, if you consider the classes of T-dual theories, they're not exactly equivalent to the original theory. So you might want to ask, okay, so we by trading off fluxes for D-brains, we lowered the gauge group from SO32 to whatever we want, nothing if we want. The logical thing to ask, well, is what does that correspond to in type 1? What can you do in type 1 that reduces the gauge group to as small as you want? And it's not true that you can identify these discrete twists with those that you can do in type 1. And a very sharp way of saying this is, there's a whole other school, mostly in Europe, that whenever something happens in string theory, it does all of the supergravity that fills in the supergravity understanding the low energy effective field theory. So what Ferrara and also Chris Hall have told us is that these twists correspond to a choice of some electric subgroup in the U-duality group, and then a Schirk-Schwarz gauging of involving monodromies in this subgroup. So these flux compactifications were sort of new to the supergravity people who had claimed to have an exhaustive classification of n equals 1, n equals 2, whatever, supergravities from gauging of isometric groups. And what they realized more recently is that there are inequivalent choices of electric subgroup. So there's one choice for the heterotic string, which is the same as for type 1, and then there's another one that corresponds to these fluxes, and they're not the same. So it's true that if you don't turn on any twisting or any flux, you can do T-dualities between the two, but there are things that you can turn on in one that don't map to the other via T-duality.
Another way, T-duality, you have a moduli space.
Yeah.
And the point is that there are, in different places on the moduli space, different descriptions are good. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee that there's anywhere on the moduli space that where a type 1 description is good. Especially because neat that in the n equals 2 case you have Zilton not frozen, but because many of your moduli are frozen, mm-hmm. you can't get to all the places that you get to in the n equals 4 theory. In n equals 4 theory, you can
make the thing big and small and get to type 1 and get to type 2.
Yeah.
But you're restricted to a submanifold of moduli space, which might never simply have a type 1 description. Or it might, but I mean, I think that's one way to think about it. You know,
this could be a complementary understanding for why.
What are all of the regions? In every region of moduli space, what is the good description? I mean, that's sort of the goal of T-duality. Now, is it only T-duality, or were there S-dualities hidden there as well? Because, I mean, sometimes Boucher's rules will give you a large dilaton.
Yeah. I think that for what I said, it was only T-duality. Uh-huh. Yeah. Thanks.